Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Happy Thursday, everybody, and welcome to episode 45 or 45. I don't know. I get confused. Of the Snyder Cut. I'm Jeff Snyder. That's who you're watching. This is my podcast slash videocast. I don't know even what we call this thing. A lot of news to dive into, and I've got a hard out this week because we've got a meeting after this. So I got to just get it started. The biggest news of the week, the VP, Kamala Harris. I like it. She's a good choice. It's a good pick by my boy Joe Biden. You know, it's like regardless of whether you think Kamala Harris was the right person or not, whether it should have been Susan Rice or Karen Bell or, you know, whoever, Elizabeth Warren, it's like we all got to get behind Harris and Biden. You know, we got to come together for the greater good and stand on the right side of history. So I'm leading with a little political note there. Regardless of how you feel about her personally, we got to get this done in November. Jesus. Okay. Where do we want to start? Let's start with Tron. I'm just going down the list. Tron 3 brought in Garth Davis to direct. An odd choice. He's never really done anything like this before. Not a big history with like VFX and stuff. I think Garth Davis is pretty much primarily known for Lion and for Top of the Lake. I love Lion. Lion was fantastic. I think it was my number 5 movie of that year. Do I care about seeing a new Tron movie? No, not at all. Not whatsoever. Do I think Jared Leto is a step up from Jared Hedlund? I do. But at the same time, do I think Jared Leto can carry a Tron movie? Absolutely not. Maybe Morbius will change my mind as far as like Jared Leto, you know, tentpole movie star, but I like Jared Leto as an actor. I do. I've always liked him, even since my so-called life days. But you know, Panic Room, Fight Club, Dallas Buyers Club. The guy's an Oscar winner, but he's better in supporting roles. You know, I don't know what the plan is with this Tron Ares thing. This is something that they've tried to get off the ground, you know, basically since Legacy. Jared Leto's been circling this for ages. I don't know why now. You know, like, is it something that they're just trying to do for Disney Plus? Because theatrically, I think that there's a real ceiling on this franchise, and I don't think that, you know, the current circumstances with the pandemic and people reluctant to return to movie theaters and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you have to be making decisions with that kind of stuff in mind, that the theatrical marketplace is never going to be what it once was, right? I don't think it can possibly be. So you have to recalibrate everything, you know, even the gigantic franchises, which I would never move, like a Jurassic or a Fast 9 or, you know, Marvel, your ceiling numbers are going to come down. That's just math. If the first Tron made $400 million exactly worldwide, and I don't know if it broke even or lost a little bit of money. I mean, who knows with all the ancillaries and stuff, but I think $400 million would be generous for Tron Ares. I'm sure Jared Leto is more expensive than Jared Hedlund and Olivia Wilde probably put together. It's just a bit of a head scratcher. I don't know that I would go to Garth Davis for this job. I'm surprised that Garth Davis went for it, but I guess nobody's beaten down his door either. I mean, he again, a really smart storyteller, and maybe that he's exactly what Tron needs because, you know, the story was what I found lacking the last time under Joseph Kosinski's direction. He could certainly do a great job with some beautiful visuals, but, you know, ultimately, movies always come down to story. So I think Garth Davis is a win on that front. He's not exactly a visual stylist. I don't know. It's not the worst decision I've seen a studio make, but it's certainly a bit of a head scratcher. God, there's so much stuff. I don't even know what to go to next. Okay. Let's do the Ben Affleck story. He signed on to direct this project, The Big Goodbye, which I believe was a high-ranking Blacklist script. It may have even topped the Blacklist. I forget. And it's about, like, the making of Chinatown and The Long Goodbye. It's a curious choice. I mean, I know that Hollywood loves movies about Hollywood. And I think Ben Affleck is a really good director. I did not care for Live by Night. That's a big stumble in my book. But, you know, I want to see Ben get back on the horse. Like I said, I think he really is a talented filmmaker. He's just a super smart guy. This choice, it just seems, I don't know, it doesn't seem like much of a challenge for him. I mean, casting's going to be a challenge. Like, you've got main characters, Jack Nicholson, Roman Polanski, Faye Dunaway. Like, who do you find to play these people? Like, I just never think it's a good idea, you know, for an actor to play a better actor than them. They're just, like, literally not capable of giving as good a performance. It just seems very inside baseball, you know? And I get why Affleck is drawn to that time period in Hollywood history, and I think there is a lot to explore there, but, you know, does it feel like a Ben Affleck movie? Not exactly. It feels like something maybe you could pull off a bit more indie. I mean, we'll see. He didn't I'll be curious to see if Ben takes a role in this himself. Who do you cast as, like, Jack Nicholson? You cast his kid? Do you cast, like, Alden Ehrenreich or something? Like, those are some big shoes to fill. I wouldn't want to be the actor who steps into those. But hey, whatever. Ben gets to do what he wants after you win Best Picture. God. I'm just looking at the list here and I'm like, it's overwhelming. I saw that Ava DuVernay is going to do a One Perfect Shot series. I mean, are we just handing out TV shows now for Twitter accounts? This is ridiculous. I was a little taken aback by it. I always liked the One Perfect Shot account. You know, sometimes they do have really good taste, but, you know, some of them, it's just like they just throw a movie frame up on Twitter and they're like, oh, isn't this just brilliant? Like, they don't need to explain themselves. I mean, I look forward to Chris Tapley's Best Cinematography Shots of the Year, hit that annual article more than I do, like, the, you know, what's going to be the one perfect shot today. I think it's, like, just a weird in for, because Ava DuVernay could make the series if she wanted to anyways, and so it's a weird in to do it, but I guess it's good branding. I mean, if you're, you know, who is going to watch a show like that? The people who are really care about movies, the people who are obsessed with that kind of stuff, and those people are on film Twitter and they're already familiar with One Perfect Shot, so in that sense it makes sense. But maybe I'm just jealous that my Twitter account has not been optioned for, you know, a movie or TV series. That's probably what it is. I guess I'm just not cinematic enough. Last week we missed a story about Ryan Reynolds signing on to do this Universal project, Everyday Parenting Tips, with Lord Miller producing, Simon Rich writing. He, you know, it's based on one of his short stories. This guy, he's just everywhere, Simon Rich. So is Ryan Reynolds, for that matter, and frankly, Lord Miller. I will say that's sort of like one thing about that I've noticed. I've just been paying attention to actors who've had announcements and things like that in the last few months. It's like the same group of people. It's like every single, like Elizabeth Moss, you know, who's in like every other story. We're going to talk about her in a second. But it's like a very, it's almost like, I know Hollywood's supposed to be opening up the ranks right now, and it is. It certainly is. But at the same time, it just feels like, you know, overall deals and so many jobs. And I mean, I know it's a lot of development stuff right now. It's not like there's a lot of casting going on for, you know, projects that are shooting imminently. So it's more development projects and the people who have overall deals. And those people tend to be bigger stars. But I don't know. I've definitely noticed that the talent pool seems to be constricting during this time of COVID. Although we're also being exposed to a ton of performers and filmmaker storytellers who we've never seen before, basically because, you know, places networks, they've run out of content. So they're just picking up these shows left and right. Like, you know, I think Hulu is another one of these places where they're just getting their hands on, you know, the hot show from Australia or from the BBC or even things that, you know, came out a couple years ago that, you know, American audiences haven't been exposed to. Like, I just finished watching We Hunt Together and that embargo lifted. Didn't get a great write-up in THR. I enjoyed it. It's, I think I've talked about it before. If not, check out the trailer. But it's about, like, a former child soldier, like an African immigrant, you know, finds himself teaming up with this white girl who's, you know, had been abused, had a rough go of it, and they start offing people, essentially, who have been, you know, who have upset her. And then there's a black and white male-female detective team that's hunting them. It's like, I never would have seen this show if it wasn't for Showtime bringing it to the U.S., and I enjoyed it. But, you know, when I check, like, my screeners queue, and I think Amazon is doing this a lot too. Like, it's full of, like, these Irish crime dramas or Scotland or, you know, wherever it is. So you're definitely going to see international formats and series start to take off. Yeah, like there's a lot more people I have my eye on lately for up and comer of the month because, you know, of this influx of new talent. Like the female lead on that Luca Guadagnino series, We Are What We Are. I think that's what it's called, the one with Jack Dylan Grazer. I have my eye on her. I need to get my hand on the screeners, you know, to see if she's got it. But she looked interesting. Adria Arjona got the female lead in the Rogue One spinoff, Cassian Andor. I mean, again, I'm not terribly familiar with her work. You know, what I've seen was like in Six Underground, which is not exactly conducive to good acting. I just, you know, can she act or is she another just like a pretty face? We'll see. I don't know. Her casting doesn't really excite me. I suppose it makes sense alongside Diego Luna. You know, they could be good together. I don't know if they're being set up for some kind of romance or not. Cassian Andor wasn't really a character who I was like, oh, I need to see a whole TV series about that guy. So I'm a little skeptical of the Rogue One spinoff, particularly with all the behind-the-scenes trouble that it's had. Is that the one that Tony Gilroy's involved with now, or did he come on to do the other one? I can't even keep track of all these fucking Star Wars characters, guys. Let's just move on, frankly. Martin Scorsese signed a first look. You know, there were some good, some interesting first look deals this week. So Scorsese signed a first look deal with Apple, which is like, what is he trying to do? Like, bankrupt this company? I mean, Marty, remember when Martin Scorsese, like, didn't need $200 million to make a movie? Those were the days. He is going to need that much to do The Killers of the Flower Moon, which starts shooting next year. That is confirmed for a 2021 shoot. It's got Leo and De Niro. And listen, I put a call out to all the basically every Native American actor who I could think of because they're going to need some Native American actors. So, yeah, guys like Wes Studi, Zahn McLaurin, like I've definitely been you know, poking around. It's just common sense. You know, might as well ask because you can bet that those actors' reps are trying to get them parts in that movie. Meanwhile, Lizzo signed a deal with Amazon. I was excited about this one. I mean, on one hand, I'm like, you know, okay, so she's a celebrity. So are people just going to watch shows because from executive producer Lizzo, maybe you get a cameo from Lizzo, maybe it's a reality format that she's judging. I don't know what these shows are going to end up being. You know, is that why you make a deal with someone like her? Or you know, does she actually have some great TV ideas? Like, you know, did they spark to a pitch? I don't know. I know that I like Lizzo. I was really happy about that news. I don't like or listen to a lot of popular music. But, you know, Stephanie got me into a lot of Lizzo stuff, and I dig it. You know, She's a lot of fun. I just like her energy, like her personality. Like she's a big girl. She doesn't make any apologies for that. She owns it. She's a real woman, that Lizzo. And so I'm looking forward to seeing what she brings to the table at Amazon. While at the same time, if I was a producer who'd been like, you know, working my ass off to get some shows off the ground, I might be a little jealous or just resentful. Like, you know, so she's good at music, so we're giving her a TV show. Like, what is that bullshit? It's just, listen, it's always been like that. That is Hollywood in a nutshell, but it's got to be frustrating, you know, when you're a writer or a producer seeing people sell shows and ideas where it's like, well, I've been working on this for ages and now she writes a, you know, a hit song and they give her a TV show. How does it make sense? Them's the breaks. It doesn't always make sense in Hollywood. Speaking of not making sense, I heard that ABC finally released that Blackish episode that they had shelved and they released it on Hulu. And I heard there was like not even anything to make a fuss about, that it was like kind of a little bit bland for something that everybody got all up in arms about. So, you know, Hollywood, it doesn't always make sense. Amazon and Blumhouse just announced a big deal. I'd heard about this one. So they're, you know, Amazon's basically going to be streaming 8 Blumhouse titles. And these are titles that are new. Some are like holdovers. Like the one that I recognize today is Vina Sood's The Lie with Mireille Enos from The Killing, who, you know, worked with Vina on that show, and Peter Sarsgaard. This is another movie in the, you know, the genre. It's basically a subgenre at this point of parents who's, you know, have a kid who's done something terrible, and so they lie to cover it up. So The Lie, I think, is going to be the first film under that deal. And then there were 3 others that were announced today, and there's going to be 4 more next year. Incredible. You know, Blumhouse is just cutting deals with everybody. Like, Amazon needs the content. They need more original movies. The Lie is, you know, a worthwhile pickup for them, even though it didn't get the greatest of reviews when it bowed. I think it was a Toronto, but I don't know if it was a Toronto or Sundance, but I think it was a Toronto back in the day. But yeah, you know, Amazon is just, I do like how Amazon is getting creative with its, you know, ways and means of finding content. You know, they definitely have had a bit of a weak slate. I mean, they've got The Boys coming in a few weeks, and I did start watching season 2 last night. I can't say anything because it's embargoed. I think Amazon has definitely been a streaming service that has not necessarily, like, taking it to the next level during this pandemic, like Netflix and even, you know, Hulu has had some stuff. Amazon's kind of disappointed me given their deep pockets and the really stellar team that I know that they have there. So, you know, maybe this Blumhouse is going to lead to other things or turn things around over there. Again, content is king. You need more content. Wave for a nice job to go out and get those Blumhouse movies. Shit. You know what I thought was interesting this week? Darren Aronofsky announced this lifeguard series, sort of like the anti-Baywatch. It's about these corrupt lifeguards. I started reading the article that it was based on. I haven't finished yet. But it was basically, it's like about the guy who has run the New York City lifeguard like department for like the last 40 years. So every like public pool, you know, he controls the lifeguards, and just like the stuff that they've done, whether it's, you know, the partying, changing coroner's reports, you know, lying about people drowning, and just I don't know, it did sound like it really made it for a great TV series. Like it could be super interesting, especially in Aronofsky's hands. It's just a world and a subculture that you don't often see explored. I mean, yeah, we had the Baywatch movie and the Baywatch TV show, but, you know, the movie was played for laughs and the TV show was always just an excuse to watch some women running in slow motion down the beach. This sounds like a series of actual substance. I miss Aronofsky. He used to be one of my favorite filmmakers, and then he's kind of flown off the handle and gone off the deep end in the last couple of years. But again, this guy did Requiem for a Dream, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary. He did The Wrestler, which is just a classic. The Fountain is incredible. Like, Aronofsky is the shit, and I really want him to, you know, return to that top echelon of filmmakers. Black Swan, I can't believe I forgot that one. So yeah, check out that article that the Aronofsky series is based on, because it's open in my browser here. It's an open tab. I just haven't finished it, but I promise it's a good read. Speaking of reading things and finding my way to entertainment, so in our Slack this week, it was popping off about the Good Sons IMDb trivia. So if you follow me on Facebook, you've already heard this story. We were talking about The Good Son, which I love. It's like one of my favorite guilty pleasure 90s movies. People were like, oh, check out the trivia on IMDb. It's all about what a terrible dad Macaulay Culkin's father is, how difficult he was. But like, apparently he threatened to pull Macaulay Culkin out of Home Alone 2 if they didn't give him The Good Son. And that The Good Son was originally going to be played by Jesse Bradford from Swim Fan. This is incredible trivia, guys. So anyways, I keep going down the trivia page, and I learned that The Good Son was banned in the UK because of its similarities to a crime that had recently occurred over there, the murder of Jamie Bulger. So I'm like, okay, well, I got to read about this crime. You know, if it had similarities to The Good Son, is this like about a killer 8-year-old? Like, what's going on? So I read up on the crime, and I'll get into that in a second. But then I learn at the end of it that that the crime was dramatized into a short film that was actually nominated for an Oscar in 2019. So it's a 2018 short that was nominated at the 2019 Oscars. I don't think it won, but I checked it out. It's available for free on Amazon Prime, as long as you're a Prime subscriber. It's 29 minutes and change, so you can watch it in under half hour. And it was incredible. It was nauseating, but I'm like a true crime junkie, so I've seen and heard it all at this point. The case is about two 10-year-old boys who lured a 2-year-old boy away from his mother and basically murdered him and left his body on train tracks to be cut in half, taken to the police station. At first, they deny having anything to do with it. They're presented with, security footage and things like that. And eventually they admit that, yeah, they were there. They were at the scene. And then eventually, they admit to participating in it, which they don't even realize, that this kid's dead. Like, one of them even says, oh, did you take him to the hospital to make him alive again? Like, it doesn't work like that, kid. But, clearly these two little boys had some real mental and emotional problems. One of them, you could tell, was sort of the driving force behind the kidnapping. The other was the driving force behind the murder. It was like, well, we've already, taken this kid. What are we going to do with him? Might as well kill him. It was so well done. It's based entirely on the transcripts of the police interviews, the detectives interviewing these two boys. The kids that they found, I thought, were tremendous. I thought they were great. The parents were good. The detectives were good. Even the little 2-year-old who they got to play the victim, I thought was really quite affecting. So if you have 30 minutes this week, check out Detainment. And it's just an example of how weird it is, the way that we find our way to certain movies. Sundance cut itself down from 11 to 7 days. I don't know who's going to be going to Sundance in January. I'm certainly not making any plans for it. I know Toronto starts virtually next month. Who's going to get the access to these things? I didn't even apply for a Toronto credential in the spring because I knew, this wasn't going to be over by the fall. Sundance, there was hope, I thought, for things to return to normal by then, or for, a vaccine to have maybe started making its way around the country, but I don't think that's going to be the case. So it doesn't matter whether Sundance is 11 days, 7 days, or 2 days. I don't think myself or anybody really from Collider is going to be attending. I would highly doubt that. And also, I don't even know what's going to be ready. Like, a lot of movies, sometimes they wait for the fall festival. So they wait for Sundance once they've heard that they've gotten in. But it's like, at this point, everybody's starving for content. Why even go to a festival? Just go make a deal, directly with a distributor. Yeah, that's what I would do. Joyce Carol Oates came out and said that she saw the first cut of Andrew Dominik's Blonde. And she said it was like a beautiful, very feminist, like she'd never really seen a movie like it. Blonde is slated for 2021. And I wonder if it's going to be released in early 2021. If we could see it in January or February, just before the qualifying deadline, that gives Dominik a little bit more time to work on it. He's a kind of meticulous in nature. I mean, I know Netflix has like a bevy of awards contenders, but if Blonde is a contender in any way, this is the year to release it. I mean, it's going to be a weak year for Oscars, you know? Like, are we just going to let – I mean, I don't know if the industry is just rolling over and letting Netflix take this one. You know, like maybe then it won't be as aggressive in future years because they sort of – well, they got their Oscar, so – I won't have to green light every movie from every black and white movie from Alfonso Cuarón. I just want to see Blonde sooner rather than later. I don't want to have to wait until next year for it, although it sounds like that may very well be the case. Joyce Carol Oates, I mean, listen, authors, you know, with Stephen King, everything's the greatest to Stephen King. He's happy with every adaptation, or at least, you know, he is, you know, leading up to the opening. So I don't put too much stock in what authors have to say about the adaptations of their work, but I also feel like Joyce Carol Oates has some integrity and she wouldn't, you know, rave about this movie if she was unhappy with how it turned out. Seth MacFarlane announced a new drama series, The Winds of War. This is like a real change of pace for him. Whatever. Not necessarily the person I want to see a big war epic from, but at the same time, he's made so much money for networks and himself. He's earned the right to do what he wants. And I mean, I'd like to see Seth MacFarlane try his hand at a horror movie. I think that could be interesting, or some kind of a horror comedy. But hey, a boy can dream. Lulu Wang signed on to Like Father, Like Son. This is something I'd been tracking since October, last October. So when it's presented as news in August via The Observer and then picked up by Variety, no less, it's like, you guys got to be kidding me. I mean, it's not a remake. It's a reimagining, blah, 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 blah. I'll tell you what I even looked into in the same email. We'll see if it comes to fruition. Jason Statham, Eastern Promises 2. That movie Body Cross that was originally developed as a sequel to Eastern Promises. Now it's going to be about like Russian gangsters and some shit or British gangsters. Who the fuck knows? I can't even keep track of the changes on that project. But it sounds like it was going to be Jason Statham. So I sent those two inquiries to Focus back in October, almost a full year ago. You know, whether Lulu Wang is really going to direct that project or not, I guess we'll see. It sounded like just very early development days a while back. She clearly wasn't happy with the leak by The Observer. Again, is that what we're doing now? We're just letting people, and I know the guy, The Observer, he's solid. And he was right. I mean, she is developing this, but it's like, did you check with anybody? Did anybody sign off on this announcement? Like, not that you need somebody to sign off, but some confirmation would be nice. Just saying, that way you don't have to get it wrong and you don't have to upset the filmmaker. Not that that's the end of the world. There's a 47, this was the what the fuck news of the week. There's a 47 Ronin sequel in the works. And it's going to be directed by Ron Yuan, who's an actor in Mulan. All that rhymes, say that three times fast. I didn't even see 47 Ronin. It looked terrible, the reviews were terrible. I don't know why. I mean, I do know why they would make a sequel to this. It's because martial arts movies actually play really well on Netflix. Why sequelize a martial arts movie that nobody really cared for? That is another question entirely. I mean, if you think you can get Keanu Reeves back for it, then you pull the trigger because it's like you're not going to get, you know, John Wick, which we'll talk about soon. So yeah, if you have a chance to get Keanu, you pull the trigger. But at the same time, I cannot see him returning to this. And this is just like scraping the bottom of the barrel. What are you doing? And it's being produced by Universal's 1440, which is like their home video production company. Like, you know, the people who make like Sudden Death 2 and Kindergarten Cop 2. So it's like, this isn't even really a proper sequel, so to speak. It's just taking advantage of maybe a brand that has some international cachet because it did some numbers overseas. Disney announced, I mean, we talked about Mulan that last week. Disney sort of, you know, mentioned this thing, Premier Access, which is essentially a paywall behind another paywall. You know, you got to pay that $6 to get inside of Disney Plus, and then another $30 once you're inside of Disney Plus to get behind the Mulan paywall. This is all to say that Mulan is going to be available on Disney Plus in probably about 3 months. So if you, or if not, you know, short of that, then it'll be available on Apple iTunes or whatever for $10 less. So if you don't feel like paying $30, it's not like you're never going to see Mulan. Wait a little while and it'll pop up in your Disney Plus queue, probably 6 months after, you know, a 3 month VOD, regular VOD window. Blast from the past yesterday when Logan Lerman and Asa Butterfield sign on to star in College Republicans. I've been writing about this project for about a decade. I remember it was going to be Daniel Radcliffe and Dane DeHaan at one point, playing Lee Atwater and Karl Rove. Now, I have no interest in politics, let alone Republican politics, let alone young Republican politics. So do I care about this movie? Not a single iota. I mean, why do I want to spend 2 hours with a young Karl Rove? Like, these kinds of projects just, like, never turn out well. But what I will say is that this script did top the blacklist. It's got Franklin Leonard producing. It's got James Shamus directing. And James Shamus, obviously, great screenwriter. He's worked with Ang Lee for ages. He ran Focus Features for ages. Made his directorial debut a couple years ago with Indignation, also starring Logan Lerman. So I do like the package here. I like the team that they've assembled. You know, when they're like, oh, I guess, you know, back in the day that they'd used composite, they created some composite characters to stand in for some Republican operatives who, you know, perhaps weren't terribly well known, but now are following the Trump regime. But it's like, yeah, oh, do I really want to be the guy sitting there in the dark? Like, oh, my God, that's young Roger Stone. Oh, my God, that's young Paul Manafort. Like, I just don't fucking care. And I don't think America's really going to care. I mean, maybe half the country will. But is that the half of the country that goes to the movies? I don't know. Seems like a losing proposition and seems like something that will definitely be on a streaming service near you. Benson Lee signed on to direct a K-pop movie with from Scooter Braun. Again, K-pop, not for me. Can't listen to it for more than about 30 seconds. Jake Johnson, this was one. So I think it was a while ago. I think whatever the last Jurassic World story was with my name on it. Jurassic World Dominion, of course. Go back in the Collider archives, find that. And I did like a whole cast list. I mentioned almost everybody who's coming back for this movie. And one person I didn't name was Jake Johnson, even though I had done the exclusive on him returning. An exclusive that was confirmed by the studio. Something happened in terms of scheduling or whatever where Jake Johnson couldn't get over there to do the shoot, you know, when they'd initially planned or whatever. And so he wasn't in the movie. Hasn't filmed his scenes yet. And I don't think the movie's like wrapped or anything. But so anyways, they are, Jake Johnson, he's been doing interviews for his upcoming Netflix series, Hoops. He said that they are trying to figure out a way for him to return to Jurassic World 3. Again, like, why do we need Jake Johnson in Jurassic World 3? Why do I even care? He played a small character in the first Jurassic World. Would it be great to have a whole reunion with everybody? Sure, but, like, it's not going to be the end of the world if this tiny little side character doesn't make his way into a sequel for 2 minutes of screen time. Like, I just... I don't get when you have to cram everything. And you're already bringing back Sam Neill and Laura Dern for like sizable roles. It just seems like an awful lot for Jurassic Dominion. But you know that franchise has always bitten off more than they can chew, and we love it anyways. LeBron teamed up with Universal on this project, New Kid. This is about, I imagine, a young black kid who gets a sort of his world rock when he starts attending a private school. That sounds like it could be interesting. Like, that's the kind of kid-friendly entertainment I think LeBron should be making. So, you know, seems like a nice project for him. God, look at this list. Jonas Coron and Chris Columbus teaming up for a Chupacabra movie in Netflix. I mean... Sure. Yes, the Chupacabra. Very, very scary. This is obviously going to be about like a kid who befriends a Chupacabra and helps him get back to his family or whatever. Gnas Farone impressed me with that Desierto. That was a nifty little movie. I don't know that I ever gave that the full credit it deserved. But hey, Netflix, the home to the Corones. That should be like the like a sign in the lobby when you walk in. And Chris Columbus is going to produce that one. James Wan producing a Knight Rider movie. Like, again, this is like such a stale property. Is it just like about a talking car? Is that the only car that can talk? We can't have another talking car movies. We gotta use that Knight Rider title. I mean, this was going to be Chris Pratt at one point, I believe. Who was going to be the voice of Kit? I don't even know. Kevin Hart? I don't need it. I don't need to revisit these 80s shows or, you know, if that's when Knight Rider aired. I don't even fucking know. I don't care. James Wan, do better. Elizabeth Moss. Now, this is a project I can fucking get behind. It's called Miss March. She's teaming with Blumhouse on this one. It's based on a book. Doesn't come out till next summer anyways, but when it does come out, I'm going to buy it and read it because it sounds fascinating. Elizabeth Moss is going to play this woman who begins to unravel after starting to suspect that her author husband, he wrote like this big book. It's like, everybody's like, you know, reading his book, but it's about like this horrible, nasty woman. And she begins to suspect that the woman is based on her. So now she's looking at her husband like, is this how you see me? Is this how, you know, what you think of me? And she just starts to fucking lose it. That sounds like a really interesting idea. I really like the movies that Elizabeth Moss has started to set up as a producer, and shows like, you know, she set up that Shining Girl show at Apple. I like her taste. I feel like we'd get along, Elizabeth Moss. Call me. There's a shakeup on the Last Airbender, series. This is another thing I don't care about. I'm just mentioning it to put it out there for you guys. I think the original creators of the show had some creative differences with Netflix and decided to walk. Netflix also acquiring Fear Street. Look at that. Look at all my Fear Street books, guys. I've been trying to write a horror script set on the beach this summer, so I've been reading The Dead Lifeguard, Party Summer, and Sunburn, looking for inspiration. I am a huge Fear Street fan. Like, I grew up reading those books, and have not been able to throw them out. So Fox made these movies. It was a very ambitious plan. They were going to like release them either 1 month on top of each other or maybe three straight summers. I forget what the actual idea was that Fox had. I think it was going to be one summer, like June, July, August. So anyways, Netflix is like, well, why don't we do that? It's because what is Fox going to do with these movies? You're not going to release them in theaters. They have very small stars. Like, the whole Fear Street thing is the brand Fear Street. It's not about Jillian Jacobs and whoever the young people are in this movie. So you can't really put it in theaters. Plus, theaters are going to be so crowded next year, next summer. It's like, if you're not a gigantic tentpole, you shouldn't even bother. It skews a little too old for Disney Plus. Like, if it was Goosebumps, I could see you sending Goosebumps to Disney Plus. Fear Street, it's a little too scary and intense for Disney Plus audiences. Do you put it on Hulu? This seems a little too big for Hulu. It's probably why Woman in the Window didn't go to Hulu. Like, it just doesn't seem Hulu can work for the right movie, like a Palm Springs, it'd be a Big Time Adolescence, or even The Binge coming up at the end of the month. But Fear Street seems like like it deserves a little bit better, and so Netflix came to the rescue naturally, and they're going to market something called The Summer of Fear next summer, which is interesting. Like, I would have expected them to put these movies out in October around Halloween. I don't know how scary they are. Maybe they're not scary enough. Or maybe it's just that Netflix didn't want to hold them a full year and has already committed its October slots to a group of movies, which I imagine is already the case. Listen, horror performs well in the summer. It's a smart play. It's a smart play by Netflix to, you know, get three finished films to add to its slate that have actual IP. You know, like, Netflix, listen, maybe they just throw these off on the streaming service without embracing the full Summer of Fear marketing plan. But what they can do after that is say, all right, well, we, you know, these Netflix or these Fear Street movies live here. Why don't you let us make our own Fear Street movie with their own choice of filmmaker? You know, Lee Janiak has already wrapped all three films for Fear Street. I saw her debut Honeymoon. It did not impress me. You know, everybody was sort of freaking out about her. She was going to do The Craft at one point. Very curious to see how, you know, she does with Fear Street, because if these movies don't work for me, I'm probably just going to write her off, frankly. All right, 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 right. Antebellum. Antebellum got kicked to VOD. So that's going to be a premium VOD release. This was the Lionsgate movie with Janelle Monáe. And what was interesting to me about this, right, okay, is that so the Janelle Monáe movie Lionsgate sends to premium VOD, and yet the Sarah Paulson movie Run, that did get a Hulu deal, right? Yes, Run heads to Hulu. So it's like, I wonder if Lionsgate is really just looking to sort of compare the two and experiment, like, you know, they don't know what kind of money Antebellum's going to bring in on PVOD. Maybe Janelle Monáe was not a Sarah Paulson-sized, a big enough star like Sarah Paulson. I mean, movie star. You know, Janelle Monáe is obviously a star and you know, just did Homecoming and everything. But, you know, I don't know that she is a open the movie herself movie star. So maybe I'm just surprised Hulu would make a Run at Run and not Antebellum. Maybe Lionsgate just thought Antebellum would work better on PVOD. It's very unusual to take these two movies. It's not that they're similar, but they are both thrillers, female led thrillers, and just go in two completely opposite directions with them. Maybe that has to do with quality. I've heard decent things about Run. I don't know if it's quite as good as Searching, but I think that people liked it. Maybe the other thing with that is that Hulu, you know, released The Act, which was sort of similar. It's, you know, The Act was about, you know, a woman with Munchausen by proxy syndrome. That seems to be what's going on in Run, although I haven't seen the movie. I'm just going off the trailer. Maybe Hulu's like, well, the research shows people want more stuff like The Act. Now we have this movie that's a lot like it, so they know just how to market it. I don't know. It was weird. And Lionsgate made those moves at the same time that they announced that John Wick 4 and 5 are going to be shot back-to-back. 5 hadn't even been announced, so they announced 5 and said, we're going to shoot it right after, as soon as Keanu Reeves is available next year. Sure. Let's just keep it going. I thought, you know, this is a really good franchise of just getting up to the Mission Impossible type of level. Like, it's just very consistent. It's reliable. It is, like Mission Impossible, pushing the action movie envelope. Like, it's showing us some really cool stuff I haven't necessarily seen before. So, you know, I'd rather be getting John Wick 4 and 5 than The Matrix 4, quite frankly. I think John Wick is a story that lends itself to just multiple chapters and continuity. Matrix, it seemed like we'd sort of reached an endpoint of that story, but who knows what Lily Wachowski has come up with. What else? Lionsgate also brought in Jonathan Levine to do Dirty Dancing. Man, Lionsgate was busy this week. And I love Long Shot. I thought Jonathan Levine did a great job with that romantic comedy. He wouldn't be the first person that I'd think of for Dirty Dancing, but Lionsgate clearly trusts him. And, you know, I think Jonathan Levine makes good movies. This was an interesting story. It broke a little bit before we taped the last podcast, but Tom Hanks coming back to play Geppetto in Pinocchio. I saw my pals Boris and Umberto giving Justin Kroll some shit for that one. Can't really do it. Yeah, I think Kroll's right on this one. I think that Tom Hanks was attached when Paul King was doing the movie. Paul King exited, and Tom Hanks was like, well, he really was why I was here. So then Tom Hanks fell out. Then they brought in Zemeckis, right? And in those Zemeckis stories, like people maybe noted, yeah, Tom Hanks was supposed to play the character when Paul King was directing, but he wasn't attached. And so, you know, now he is attached, and that merits a new story. Yeah, like it. I understand why Kroll took some shit for that one, but at the same time, it did feel like a new development on that project. The only thing that I didn't really get was the whole script thing. You know, like it was like, you know, well, now Hanks read the script and now he's in. It's like, well, isn't it really like kind of the same script that Paul King was working with? Like, but yeah, as soon as Zemeckis signed on to that one, it was kind of obvious. Like, so you've got Zemeckis, got Tom Hanks, who had agreed to play this part for a director he had not worked with before. Now Zemeckis comes in, his good buddy. You don't think he's going to play that part again if Disney asks him to? Of course he is. But, you know, it's not an of course. From a reporter's perspective, you know, it was worth a follow-up story from Deadline. So nice job on that scoop from Kroll, who's really been killing it over there since he went to Deadline. It's just a scary 1-2 combo. AMC reopening with 15-cent movies. People are up in arms about this one. Are people just up? Like, this is why I'm off Twitter. Are people just up in arms over everything? Of course, they got to have a deal like this. It's not about, listen, it's not about making money at first. It's about showing people that theaters are safe. That is what you have to demonstrate. That's why you say, come in and, we'll, you know, pay 1920s prices and watch Jumanji, The Next Level for 15 cents. And rent out the whole theater while you're at it. Rent out the whole theater for you and your friends for $1.50. Okay? Maybe none of them show up. Maybe you change your mind at the last second. Okay, you're down $1.50. That's not a big deal. But to say, hey, I just rented out a theater and mom, dad, grandparents, you know, come watch a movie. I'm sure a lot of people are just dying to get out of the house. So this is to test. It's a test run. It's to see how many people are actually coming back out to movies. And I think AMC has to do it. Now, AMC also sort of hinted that ticket prices and concession prices were going to have to go up to sort of make up for the lost revenue over these last few months. I'm sorry, but that's bullshit. Like, I understand that, you know, theaters were having a tough time, but I don't really understand why that has to – like, I'd rather – if theaters have to go away, and my colleague Ali Jamel wrote a piece on why they won't return to movie theaters, I just don't think it's my responsibility, you know, this pandemic. Like, I know we all got hurt. Some of us got hurt as well. I'm sure millions of moviegoers too. It's not on them, you know, to now have to start paying $1 or $2 extra for a movie or for, you know, popcorn, when it's like, we're already taking a big leap here by risking our lives to even be here. So now you're going to hit my wallet too. I really hope AMC reconsiders that. Frankly, I think prices need to come down to really bring the movie business back to where it needs to be to get people inside theaters. You got to bring prices down, not jack them up. Ray Fisher keeps mouthing off about Geoff Johns and what a terrible toxic experience he had on the set of Justice League. Ray Fisher, just stop talking. I know it's not a popular sentiment. We gotta let people be heard. We gotta get the abusers out of the industry. If you want a career in this industry, Ray Fisher, again, some helpful advice. Just stop talking. Just move on. It's not like it's currently happening. This happened years ago. Like, it doesn't make you look good. It does not make people want to work with you. I promise you this. You know, when you're cursing out executives and producers, do you think other executives and producers are like, I can't wait to work with this guy? Because what if there's a, you know, I want you to read this line. Ray Fisher's like, well, I don't feel comfortable reading that line. Well, if I insist on making you read it, now am I going to read about myself being a toxic asshole in 3 years? Like, Ray Fisher, it's just like, just take the high road, man. Take the high road. You didn't do anything wrong here. I get it. You're trying to, you know, you got to use your voice and that kind of thing. But I just think Geoff Johns is probably the wrong target here. Again, I don't know the specifics, again, because Ray Fisher doesn't come out and give any specifics. He just sort of lobs these grenades and then runs away, from the ensuing fallout. It's not a good strategy, and I wish his agent would talk some sense into him. Going down the list. The top 10 highest paid actors list came out this week. That was interesting. A lot of these people can thank Netflix for that. It's like, you know, The Rock again, second year in a row, Ryan Reynolds. They both pocketed huge checks for Red Notice. It's guys like Mark Wahlberg and Adam Sandler who both had big Netflix movies. Vin Diesel. There's one Bollywood surprise. Akshay Kumar was, I think, number six. You had guys like Will Smith, who's, you know, always going to be on it because of endorsements and various things like that. He's got all kinds of revenue streams, Instagram, Snapchat shows. 10 was Jackie Chan, who's still killing it. I don't know how old Jackie Chan is. The guy's ageless. He's still kicking ass up there on the big screen. So yeah, it was just, you know, check out our 10 highest paid actors list on Collider because I thought that was pretty interesting. Jason Bateman teaming up with Mark Millar on a show called Superworld. The Michelle Pfeiffer movie, French Exit, closing New York Film Festival. Again, all the festival choices this year are just very, very odd. The DOJ, or a federal judge, ended the Paramount decrees, which allows movie studios to now own theaters. Do I think that movie studios are going to be in a rush to buy their own movie theater chain? No. So the whole, you know, thing is kind of much ado about nothing. It doesn't really change too much stuff. Robert Pattinson had a funny story where he told Chris Nolan that he had something come up and he had to, you know, take a little break from Tenet to duck back to the States for something. I think he said it was a family emergency. I don't have the story in front of me, but Nolan just called him out and was like, "You're going to audition for the Batman, aren't you?" And he was like, "Yes." Zac Efron starring in Three Men and a Baby. That remake. I really, you know, I remember the original. I really liked it. The sequel did not do nearly as well, Three Men and a Little Lady. Zac Efron is a good choice for this. You know, I think he's funny. I think that, you know, if families like him, he's a homegrown Disney star. I'm going to be very curious to see who they get to join him. All right, I did have to think about this. I remember I did promise this. Okay, so I was thinking maybe I think you need some diversity. You need probably a black guy, and then maybe a gay guy. I'd like to see a gay man as a lead in Three Men and a Baby because gay men can be parents too. You know, God, even, you know, I keep thinking of Riz Ahmed, and obviously he's not a black guy, but I kind of feel like I could see him. It's like the easy answer is like, oh, Michael B. Jordan. But I've seen Michael B. Jordan and Zac Efron before, you know? Riz Ahmed and Zac Efron could be interesting. And so he would sort of fulfill that diversity slot, so to speak. Who would be like a good gay man? I mean, like, they don't all have to be the same age. I could see somebody maybe a little bit older. Billy Eichner. I'd love to see Billy Eichner, you know, playing a dad alongside Zac Efron or something like that. I don't know why Billy Eichner is always my default answer whenever it's like, you know, about a gay character, but I fucking love Billy Eichner. Disney, no 4K releases coming for its library. I don't really care. I'm not, you know, DVD is fine with me, Blu-ray. I don't need the top of the line 4K. You know, why are you releasing this? You guys are burying all the Fox titles. I don't really get what all the furor was about this week. HBO picked up the George Carlin documentary, which I knew they would. That was obvious. I mean, Apatow, Michael Bonfiglio, George Carlin, who did like 14 specials for them. Well, obviously wasn't going anyplace else, but, and so I said as much when I initially wrote up that story back in early June. And of course, when it comes time to confirm the deal, you know, Deadline gets the press release. Now, the Deadline just gets so much stuff just handed to them on a platter. I wonder how many publications think of its writers as, oh, that guy's a good reporter. He breaks a ton of stuff. This guy is great. It's all just handoffs. It's just it's ridiculous. I'd love to see half of Deadline staff come over to Collider and do the same thing. Sean Ashmore joined the boys. Again, can't talk about the boys, but I've always liked Sean Ashmore. Excited to see him pop up on the series. Details were revealed about Star Trek and Quentin Tarantino's 30s project, the one written by Mark Smith, was going to be like a 30s set gangster type of thing. S.J. Clarkson is no longer attached to direct Star Trek 4 with Chris Hemsworth and Chris Pine, the one that they were developing. And it sounds like Noah Hawley's script has been put on pause. Then there was a shakeup at HBO Max. Bob Greenblatt, Kevin Reilly are out. Reilly's already been rumored for the Peacock gig. Again, it's the same executives just up for the same jobs over and over and over. And if you looked, I think the Ankler did something about this. Everybody's always like, they're all 50 and up. What happened to like giving Mike DeLuca a new line at like 30 years old? There's no like late people in their late 20s, early 30s, 30s, even in their 40s running stuff anymore, calling the shots in Hollywood. And I think that the town is worse off for it, that we've been dealing with the same executives for ages. I have a meeting, but I still have stuff that I want to talk about. The Judas and the Black Messiah trailer look great, like incredible. Devil All the Time looks good. Unpregnant looks like the anti Never Rarely Sometimes Always on HBO Max. I'm looking forward to the Walton Goggins thing, John Bronco. Magic Camp had a trailer that came out. Yikes. I'm thinking of Ending Things got a trailer. I got that screener in my Netflix queue. I'm going to watch that this weekend. Woke looks interesting on Hulu. Pure on HBO Max. The Mole Agent, this trailer about like a senior citizen who goes undercover in a nursing home. Alone, the serial killer thriller looks really good. The Third Day and The Undoing on HBO, those look interesting. So just a lot of trailers this week. I don't think I'm going to have time to take mailbag questions, unfortunately. So, Derek Walker, we will get to your questions next week. RIP Sumner Redstone. Redstone is a Boston family. My grandfather knew him a little bit. He passed at 97. Did a lot of good things. He was a tough businessman, though. And my last pitch, go to Beantown Strong to buy Biden-Harris masks, guys. You can also buy all kinds of other stuff on there. But BeantownStrong.com, that's my plug for the week. I've got to go. I've got to wrap things up. We've got a meeting. That'll do it for the Snyder Cut this week. A rushed ending. I know. I apologize. I'll be back next week, and we'll pick up where we left off. Have a wonderful weekend, gang. Stay tuned. Bye, Ned.
Stay little Chico Pitbull, Mr. 305, better said Mr. Worldwide. And I'm here to tell you about my new podcast, From Negative to Positive. Brought to you by my friends over at State Farm. I believe that to have success, you got to play the game so that the game doesn't play you. You know, the biggest risk you take is not taking one. It's very important that you make sure that you make the most out of your money, especially when it comes to insurance. State Farm offers surprisingly great rates. They have great agents standing by helping you personalize your coverage. All this is backed up by award-winning, easy-to-use technology. It's a great price with an even greater service. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report. Limitations apply.